Hi, and welcome to Teen Health Matters. My name is Dr. Jacqueline Dujay, and I'm the Medical Director for Child Health at the Howard County Health Department. I want to welcome you to our first podcast for Teen Health Matters, where we're going to talk about health issues facing teens in Howard County. The focus of today's podcast is on health relationships, and we have a special guest, Dr. Maria Trent. She's an adolescent young adult expert, but she also has some other credits to her name. She's an associate professor of pediatrics at the Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine. She also has joint appointments in the Department of Population, Family, and Reproductive Health Sciences at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health and the Johns Hopkins School of Nursing. And she's also the director of interdisciplinary training for the Johns Hopkins Leadership in Education and Adolescent Health Training Program, director of the Adolescent Medicine Fellowship Program, and director of training for the D.C. Baltimore Research Center on Child Health Disparities. So I'd like to welcome Dr. Trent as we talk about health relationships. So hi, Dr. Trent. How are you doing today?
Hi, Dr. Dujay. Thank you for having me today.
I'm glad that you were able to join us today. For our first topic today for our Teen Health Matters, we want to talk about healthy teen relationships. Because we know that, you know, teens have multiple relationships from family to friends, could be casual, and even romantic relationships. And they play an important role for teens. But sometimes it's hard to know, you know, even if you've been in an established relationship, you've had a friend since sixth grade or fifth grade, sometimes it can get a little rocky. So just trying to figure out and talking with teens of like how they know that they're in a healthy relationship. So just wanted to throw that out to you and see what your thoughts were.
So, you know, what's interesting is that young people very much before adolescence, very much before young adulthood, have relationships. And I think we all have them. And you can even see young children in the daycare setting, as an example. You go to pick them up one day and they have their own friends and they're saying goodbye to their teacher. They might hug their teacher goodbye. And so very early, many of our young people know how to create relationships outside of the family. I think what we see, though, is that in those early stages, they're still very much connected to home. So then when you arrive at the door, some of those other relationships fall away and they run to you and they're so glad to see you at the end of the day. I think that some of that shifts a little bit during adolescence, and I think that's okay. It doesn't mean they don't still feel that inside. It certainly might not be cool for them to walk up to you with that big hug at the end of the day, but I think adolescents still very much rely on their relationships with their parents and their families because that serves as home base. So I just wanted to put that out there because I think oftentimes when we think about adolescents and young adults, we really focus on their romantic relationships and sometimes their friendships with their peers, just general friendships. But I do think it's really important that we also emphasize the importance of families. And we talk a lot in sort of my field in adolescent medicine and health about, you know, young people's rights. And one of the things that I hold as a tenet is that every young person deserves to have as a right an activated and engaged adult throughout childhood, adolescence, and into young adulthood. And as an adult, I find it extremely valuable that I have that touch point of my own mother even now. And so those relationships change in their nature, but they're still very important. I think young people are actually very discerning, can be very discerning about their relationships. They can say, no, that person's not my friend because of the way they talk to me or the kinds of things we do together, or we don't have anything in common. I think they can sort those things out very carefully. I think oftentimes, certainly for platonic friendships, I think that when they evolve, I think those are the times that young people struggle. So somebody who's been your friend since kindergarten and now you're in middle school, you may have drifted. You know, that person may be into music and you may be into sports. They redistrict the schools and now we go to different schools and we have to create different peer groups. And it seems that that person now has another set of people that they hang out with and you feel a little isolated. I think those things are common. And in many ways, they're normative, but they can still be a little hurtful to the team. So it may be that that person is still really their friend, but they drift away because they have less opportunities to continue to build that relationship. And then it requires the teen to build new relationships with new people. And depending on the personality of the young person, that transition can be hard to walk into a space where you don't know anybody or where you might not have a friend that's traveling with you. And it's because it's in the, at that age group, is so important in many ways to have at least someone. And one of the things that I ask young people when they come to see me for their well visits, mm-hmm. tell me, do you have a best friend? And sometimes it troubles me when young people can't identify that person. I then say, well, if you had a secret, do you have somebody you could tell, who you could trust with it? And oftentimes I'm shifting back to family, but sometimes young people identify a person who's in their peer group that they could trust with a secret, because secrets can vary. You know, they can be really serious secrets, or they could be like, oh, I have a crush on such and such. And then I said, if you were in trouble, do you have a person you can tell? And then I expect it to shift back to the parent or another adult in their lives. And so I think that maintaining those relationships can be tricky. So I think I think young people have a good sense, a good gestalt about those things. People who they can trust, people who they can talk easily with without feeling uncomfortable, people who they feel like they can share the smallest of secrets, people they can go to for help. I do find that in adolescence, young people help each other a lot. They're expected developmentally to help each other. It could range from, we have a project due at the end of this week. You're my friend, and you're also been assigned to be in my group. Can I count on you to do your part? You know, because grades are important to me. Can I count on you to do your part? You say you're going to pick me up after school. Can I count on you to be on time to meet me? And I think those are the things that is one way to tell if a person is a reliable person in your life, because I think research has shown that young people like people they can trust, people they can count on. Reliability is a huge issue. It gives people authenticity and credibility, and young people can sense it and see it if it's there.
And what about, I'm a mom of teenagers, and sometimes, and even when I was a teenager, some of the, you know, like the example you gave about now you have to work on a project together, or you're relying on your friend to do something for you in that relationship. Are there tips or experiences or tips that you have for a teen that's trying to negotiate? Because let's say, you know, you have a good friend, but you know that sometimes there, you know, which friends maybe the best student or the one to count on, but in some instances you might be with the friend that's not the quote unquote the best student. So like, then how do you really negotiate? What are good ways to negotiate relationships?
So I think that young people learn very early, certainly it's been my experience as a parent here in Howard County, what their friend skill sets are. Mm-hmm. I think they know what they are. And so one person might not be the best public speaker in the group, and another person might be an artist in the group, and so you have a public speaker, another person's better at doing the art, another person's a better writer. So you try to, one of the things you can do is when you are in a group situation, you can identify what the strengths are in your group and say, let's see what things we're good at. And let's figure out a way to build on those strengths so we have the best project together. And so I think sometimes we assign people tasks, or we're not vocal in saying, you know, I'm not great at that. If that's what the group wants me to do, but I just want to put it out there that if we have to make a poster or we have to draw something, that's really my gift. I'm not a public speaker, but I know, Jackie, that you're a great public speaker. If I did the artwork, would you be willing to be the one who presented it for our group, because the presentation is also really important? And so really, one, it's speaking up for yourself in a thoughtful way, in a nice way, in a kind way, but being honest. I think one of the things that oftentimes people are reluctant to do in adolescence is because they are not confident in sort of saying, this is my skill set, because they don't use that kind of language. They feel like, I should have that skill set. I should have it. And so they're not able to articulate that to a friend. Sometimes another person is musically inclined. Another person is a better debater. So I think that the tricky thing is that in adolescence, they're learning what their gifts are. And so sometimes it takes a friend to say, I noticed that one of the things you're really good at is this. Or can you take notes for our group and organize them so that when we go to write up our piece, we've got good notes. And so really trying to find the strengths in that other person that you know as your friend, identifying what your own strengths are. And I think it's communication. Now, I will say that I love technology. I text my own daughter. I text my husband. I love email. I love faith. I love all of those things. But I will say, when it comes down to establishing relationships and communicating, I think we communicate best through those other platforms if we have a good face-to-face relationship. And we've actually done that research at Hopkins around how people best want to communicate with us. They're like, you can text me, but I would feel better getting a text message from you, Dr. Trent, if I know it's from you. So I think you still have to work on those other relationships, the face-to-face communication, the spending time together that's not technologically reliant to build relationships. So I encourage young people to actually sit down, look at each other, and talk to each other. It sounds like an old school kind of thing, but I think it's a skill that young people today, despite our access to technology, continue to have. And they have to do stuff together. You know, they have to, you know, go to the movies or have an adventure. And so I really try to facilitate that, you know, as a parent, having safe spaces for my young people to engage their friends and their peers. I might be close by, but to really allow them the chance to build those relationships. And they can do that through music and sports and after school activities, community things. Many people have those things built into their religious faith environments as well. And so I think there are a lot of places people can build those safe relationships in a face-to-face way.
So even using the technology, like you said, their parents is still text. So any tips for parents to engage with their young people? Because I think as, you know, sometimes with parents, you know, their teens are more independent. And sometimes they feel like, oh, you know, my teen's not going to want to hang out with me. So I see a lot of parents reverting to texting their kids, you know. So I'm just wondering, like, even that relationship, that parent-child relationship, using technology. And would you say the same thing holds true about doing things together and putting away the technology as well?
I would say that. I would also say that I think a parent's job in many ways in adolescence is to listen and to be open to their young person when they're ready to talk. So it's hard to predict because they might not want to talk today. But then you might be doing something and they're like, you know, I need you to get off your computer. This is a quote. I need you to get off your computer because I'm talking to you, right? So I think, and you have to be prepared in those moments to just let it go and to listen. Another great time is we transport our young people everywhere. You know, when I grew up, you got your driver's license when you were 16 because I lived in a rural community and everybody got their driver's license. It was actually taught in school because it was just, you had to learn how to drive. Here, less so, you know, some people do learn how to drive early, but, you know, we have graduated licenses. It's a whole process to it. But we spend a lot of time, many parents, particularly in the suburbs, in the car with our young people, taking them places, taking their whole group of friends places. And sometimes it's cool to just sit back and listen. When they're by themselves, sometimes they'll just start talking to you. If they might have a friend in the car, they'll start talking with the friend. You can learn all kinds of things about their existence. I wouldn't say engage. Sometimes you can engage the two of them together if that's the nature of the relationship. But sometimes after the friend is gone, because if you don't ask it in quite the right way, it can be embarrassing, those kind of things. You can say, I didn't know about that. Can you tell me about that? And then they'll say, yeah, this happened. And you learn so much. And so I think listening is the first thing. Being open to when they're ready to talk, but also not letting yourself be pushed away. So when they have an event, you're there. Sometimes when they need chaperones, you should go and just to see what's going on. If you can make your house the place that all the teens want to come and hang out, that's great. Because I think you have opportunity not only to figure out who your child is becoming, but you see how they are around other people. When they have sporting events, to go and see, to meet the other parents, to create that other sense of community around your child. Because you described this thing we call this social ecological framework in terms of how we think about adolescence as this, you know, there's the adolescent in the center, then there's the family, and the units get bigger and bigger. You know, then there's the school community, there's the faith community, there might be a sports community that they're in, the drama performance community that they're in. But all of those things, in many ways, have other young people in them. They have other adults in them. So in that safety net, there should be other friends. There should be coaches. There should be other parents. And, you know, we create that for every child in our community. Parents navigate how they want that to look in many ways for their child. But some of it we don't control. You know, you say they get a list of teachers at the beginning of the year, and that's a part of their safety net. And it's really us working together to help them navigate that and those relationships. Sometimes they might come home, they have a relationship with their teacher, they might be frustrated with the teacher, and really talking them through it and how they navigate that relationship is also really important. So we're still the guides. We're that activated and engaged parent through that, even if they're trying to dip out just a little bit to grab hold of autonomy. I'm a believer that autonomy is something that young people should have, but I also think that it requires parental trust, and I think young people have to earn that trust from their parents. And so we give it out in little bits until, because I think sometimes you give too much, it can be overwhelming for the young person, and then they make mistakes that they regret.
We touched a little bit about friends and parent-child relationship. I want to move on a little bit about and talk about like romantic relationships as teens try to navigate either a significant other, you know, same sex or opposite sex, whomever they have a romantic attraction to, and how they know that the relationship that they want to enter in is also considered a healthy relationship. Would you say some of the same tools or same techniques for a platonic friendship would also apply to a romantic relationship?
So I would say that those early relationships, platonic relationships, are critical for understanding how they navigate a romantic relationship, right? In many ways, I think of it as those friendships, but a little extra. It's how I think about it. There's this extra special feeling that you get in terms of being with that person that you can't really explain, but that you know is there. Oftentimes, there are other things that young people can identify. The person is very physically attracted to them, how the person makes them feel when that person talks to them. And I think that there are lots of types of reasons why a person can be drawn to another person. We have the same interests, but oftentimes it's really that attraction to the other person. I think if you have the attraction, but there's nothing else there, I think sometimes that sets people up for hurt. So if they don't have anything else in common, aside from how that person makes them feel, and the person is not willing to say, well, I'm interested in this and you're interested in that, but I'm going to try that, or I'm going to go and support you doing that because you're interested in it, because I really like you, right? And so it's really that other person taking that interest in you, in addition to sort of that attractiveness that comes with it, that sort of makes it work, I think.
And what about, I guess, the communication, talking? Because I hear sometimes, you know, sometimes relationships can be, it's hard to have that first conversation, or even figure out like what to talk about. You know, should there be a special topic to talk about? Or, you know, you just talk about, like you said, shared interests.
So, you know, light topics always work best for new situations, topics you're comfortable talking about. If you can find something in common, that's a great way to start a topic. Oftentimes, people are in, you know, in school settings, especially where they have had an opportunity to really observe that person well before any kind of approach is made. People know a lot about the person, maybe even, but it's mostly maybe by observation, or maybe somebody who is on a team with you or who's shares a class with you and they've been eyeing you from across the room. That thing can certainly happen. So oftentimes people know, but it's the anxiety sometimes for that first introduction and sort of expressing that they are interested maybe in the extra, right? And how to communicate with that. And I think that how people handle that varies. Sometimes it's very upfront, but I think sometimes for a person who's new to relationships, that can be a little scary. Some young people have boundaries set on what types of relationships they are kind of allowed to have. And so setting an agenda around that, I think, is really important. But it really does require a person who sort of knows themselves, what they're capable of, to navigate those things effectively. But I would say that talking to people is the best way. If somebody texts you and says, hey, would you like to, you know, go out to the movies? I mean, that's very lightweight. Hopefully there's some other conversation other than that text, right? Because then they're there together. So it's almost easier if you can get over the hump of like talking to that person before that big event. It will lay the groundwork for having something to talk. You could even talk about, oh, I was so nervous asking you to go out with me to the movies. But you know, how funny is that? Because I'm really having a good time with you. Because you can even refer back to that event because it says it was important to me. I'm sharing something from my feelings, but in a really lightweight way about our whole doing this together. And then it allows you to build on that relationship. So I think communicate. Technology, again, is still very important, oftentimes in maintaining a relationship. But sometimes young people have to really get the courage up to deal with that face-to-face communication if they want to have healthy relationships long-term.
So I think, like you mentioned, communication is key. And I think also the issues of negotiating a relationship. And like you said, too, you know, kind of have an agenda, like, for what the date's going to be about. But even beyond that date, you know, the second, third date, and more expectations that each person has. What would you say to a teen in terms of negotiating their relationship? I mean, they're tough issues that young people have to deal with, especially, you know, all the stuff on the media. It seems like all kids are having sex. There's a stereotype of what a teen relationship should be like on, you know, TV movies and stuff like that. So, but I think what it comes down to, like you're saying, is that for the most part, you have a communication, a basic communication and understanding, but still sometimes it's difficult to negotiate and tell somebody what your limits are, boundaries are, or what you expect out of that relationship.
So, you know, that's interesting, because I actually think that while I think people think that most teens are having sex, I wouldn't say most of them are. I would say about half of teens have had sex before they graduate from high school. But I would say that many young people actually leave home and go to college sexually inexperienced. In some ways, without the safety net of having to establish some of those dating relationships earlier, they are vulnerable. So I'll just put that out there. I'll tell you one of my biases. I think that young people, the longer they can wait to have sex and figure out what kinds of relationships that they want to be in, and really test these relationships which I'm calling with a little bit of extra in terms of friendship, negotiation, spending time together, knowing the person, really having someone invest in them, then when the sex part comes, I think it will be much more meaningful for them. I do see young people all the time in my practice who are having sex, so I will say that as well. And my job is to help them stay safe and healthy in that context. But I also talk to a lot of young people, especially young women, which is the focus of a lot of my research and a lot of my own interests, who are having sex and they're not enjoying it, or it's not really benefiting them. And so that's my only caveat, is because there can be consequences to sexual relationships. And if there are consequences, those can range from health consequences, emotional consequences. Breakups are hard, especially if they feel like they invested so much in it. So I think that is a part of that process too. So the longer that young people can actually spend trying to figure out whether or not this person is someone I want to have that kind of relationship, really investing a little, you know, some time and figuring out, is this person just looking good, smelling good, and just wonderful and so good looking? Is that it? You know, and they, you know, and we have great things to talk about. Is that enough? You know, when something gets difficult, does that person have my back? What kind of relationship do I want to have with that person? Really asking yourself those questions before you take that kind of next step. Because I do see young people experience the sort of waxing and waning of those relationships. Now, what I will say is that I also understand quite clearly that adolescence can be about risk-taking. But the brain is wired in a way that's how it's supposed to work, right? So young people take risks all the time. And I think people fixate on sort of the sex, drugs, rock and roll risks when they think about young people. But they take tons of risks. They take risks, for example, to go to that new middle school as a new student who doesn't know anybody. They walk in there alone and they manage the day, they make friends, they meet new teachers, and they figure out how to do that. They try out for sports, not knowing whether they're going to make it or not. And they navigate whether that they make the team they want to be on and get the coach they want. They navigate walking up to a group of peers and saying, hey, can I sit at this lunch table? Those are risks that young people take. Young people take risks. They pack up their stuff when high school is over, many of them, and they leave home. Or others say, I'm going to take a risk and I'm going to stay here. I'm going to go to my community college and then I'm going to take that risk, because they're still young people, but they take risks. I'm going to get in a car and learn how to drive it. They do those things. And so that's what adolescence is about. And I think our job as parents, again, and as adults in the community, are really to provide a safety net on helping them navigate. We also are able to provide some boundaries. So this is me talking to the parents. So I think that it's also young people want us to say to them, you know, this is what I know about relationships. This is what my experience has been. This is how I want you to navigate it. And this is how I can help you. And I think when people, parents know that, when young people hear that from their parents, sometimes they may seem like they're not listening, but they are. They're also watching us. They're watching us in how we talk to each other, how we talk to them, how couples are together, how we talk about other couples, how we talk about dating, and they take cues from it in terms of how they are going to navigate it, because they are sponges and they are using all of the things in their environment to help them make good choices. Because again, they're riding the bus alone, they're at school alone, they're doing their sport, they're doing a lot of stuff without us. And so it's up to us to provide them with ongoing support about making those choices.
And then as a parent, or even having that close relationship, you've established that close relationship, how would you recommend talking to teens about, you know, we're establishing the bounds of a healthy relationship, but what if unfortunately you have a friend who's in intimate, you know, domestic violence or intimate partner violence, or them themselves, they feel like there's some kind of physical abuse or verbal abuse?
So I think initially people know when relationships are not safe, but they are often challenged by what they feel pressures that make them feel like they should deal with it. I think that that's unfortunate. I think that if someone hurts you, and I use hurt in a broad way, hurt can mean somebody who constantly makes you feel bad about yourself, never has a kind word to say, certainly to the extreme of the person who hits you or does something that's abusive towards you, embarrasses you in front of people purposely, is disrespectful to you in front of their friends, and that goes across gender. I think those are signs that that person is not doing all those things we talked about early on in terms of making it a safe relationship for you. And I think we have to talk to them about how they can step away from that in a safe way. We also have to say, if we know our young people are dating in particular, to say, this is, we have to verbalize that to them. And to say to them, if you feel like you're ever in that situation, you can always pick up the phone and call me. No matter what the situation is, I will always come and pick you up. You can always come to me and tell me. And I might not be happy about it right away, but I will always be there for you. And I think young people, that's what they want in this situation. I know you're trying to make these choices, but I'm not going anywhere. And I think then they will come to you when they're in those situations. And then you can identify people in the community that are the safe places. You know, as a pediatrician and adolescent medicine doctor, I want parents to feel safe saying you could go talk to Dr. Trent, because I'm here as a part of the safety net to have their child's back and to help them navigate that and to help connect them with resources as they navigate getting out of that situation or managing it effectively.
I want to thank you today, Dr. Trent, for joining us and talking to us about healthy relationships and the important role that family has talking with teens about healthy relationships.